One year ago, with your leadership, I signed the Inflation Reduction Act into law. And one of the most significant laws I think has ever been enacted. Taking on the special interest and winning,
Now, is it really winning if you're winning but no one knows you're winning? Just ask.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for your listening convenience on the internets and the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com. Happy travels, Nicole. Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Verdon Square Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us for another thrilling edition of The Bradcast. Glad to have you here with us. Okay, coming up, it has been, as you heard at the top, a year, believe it or not, since the passage of Joe Biden and the Democrats' landmark Inflation Reduction Act, which includes the largest single investment ever made by Desi Doyen, I think, any government or anyone else.
Correct. In the entire world, in the history of the world.
In the history of mankind.
Yep.
To help mitigate climate change. And crucially, to help bring manufacturing supply chains and hundreds of thousands of jobs back to the U.S. So is it working? As you heard Joe Biden say at the top there, they're taking on the most powerful interests in the world and they are winning. Is he winning? Is it working to either mitigate our climate crisis or spur a clean energy manufacturing renaissance in the U.S.? And by the way, if it is working, does anybody actually know if it's working? Do they know what is working? Particularly as Joe Biden enters his reelection year, and despite all of the very good economic indicators on paper, Americans, for some reason, either don't seem to be feeling it or they aren't giving Joe Biden credit for it. And as our long, cruel summer proves, the climate crisis is quickly worsening. Well, we will discuss all of that and more with the great David Roberts, who we also haven't spoken to for a year now. Last time we talked to him was after the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, so he's back. First, however, it's one of those stories that prevents us from talking about stuff like the IRA, stuff that actually matters to most Americans. So apologies in advance, but it's kind of impossible to ignore, yes, the impeachment of a president, the attempted impeachment of a president in any event, no matter how ridiculous it may be. So on Tuesday, as we discussed in our previous show, on the very first day, their very first day back in Congress after the August summer recess, and just 11 days after House Speaker Kevin McCarthy had announced that he would not do that same undemocratic thing that Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats did back when she unilaterally announced that there would be an impeachment inquiry of Donald J. Trump back in 2019, which, as Republicans argued at the time, made the entire inquiry unlawful or unconstitutional or whatever it was that they were arguing. Well, McCarthy and the Republicans, they would not make that same mistake, that same egregious constitutional error. By McCarthy, he wouldn't do that. He would not simply unilaterally declare an impeachment inquiry against Biden without holding a vote of the full House. As McCarthy told the right-wing Breitbart outlet just 11 days ago, quote, to open an impeachment inquiry is a serious matter, and House Republicans would not take it lightly or use it for political purposes.
Gosh, it sounds like he means it.
The American people deserve to be heard on this matter through their elected representatives, McCarthy said, adding, quote, that's why if we move forward with an impeachment inquiry, it would occur through a vote on the floor of the People's House and not through a declaration by one person. Well, on Tuesday, just 11 days after he'd vowed otherwise, one person, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, I'll be damned, declared an impeachment inquiry without a vote through elected representatives on the floor of the People's House. Weird. And now, of course, it's starting to make me wonder if I, you know, can no longer trust the good faith and promises of Kevin McCarthy. But of course, there may be a reason for Kev's about face on Tuesday. It seems that he wouldn't even win if the matter was voted on in the People's House, at least based on the opposition to this entire matter from Republican leadership over in the U.S. Senate. Just a few hours before McCarthy's announcement, The Hill ran a piece on the opposition to an impeachment inquiry, whether it was voted on or not, from several top Senate Republicans who say that the House GOP does not appear to have enough evidence to pursue impeachment proceedings against President Biden. They were skeptical, according to The Hill's Alex Bolton, who reported about the prospect of setting up an inquiry with multiple committees in the House already investigating the president and his son, Hunter Biden. Bolton reported that Republican senators are highly skeptical that McCarthy could even muster enough votes in the House to pass an article of impeachment, and they warn it would be quickly dismissed if such an article ever got to the Senate, possibly going without a full trial. Their message to House conservatives, as The Hill describes them, don't distract from the issues where Republicans will have the upper hand in the 2024 election, the economy and border security, as they see it, to pursue a fruitless impeachment effort. Texas Senator John Cornyn, a member of the Senate GOP leadership team, said, quote, it really does come down to how you prioritize your time. I don't know of anybody who believes Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer will take it up and actually have a trial and convict a sitting president. Cornyn noted that House Republicans could investigate the Bidens without launching a formal impeachment inquiry because they control the lower chamber. Quote, members of the House don't really care what I think. All I can tell you, it's unlikely to be successful in the Senate, he said. Rather than doing something they know is unlikely to end the way they would like, maybe they want to emphasize other things, he politely, if somewhat hilariously, added. Cornyn is far from alone. Senate Republican Whip John Thune of South Dakota expressed reservations about linking a bill to avoid a government shutdown to a vote on launching impeachment proceedings, which is what McCarthy seems to be doing in hopes of placating his far-right caucus here and the party's current, the GOP's current front runner for president, who historically became the first president to be impeached twice during his term as president. Asked if she thought there's enough votes to impeach Biden, West Virginia's Senator Shelley Moore Capito, another member of the GOP leadership team in the Senate, replied, quote, I do not, unquote. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, for his part, said attempting to impeach a sitting president, quote, should generally be avoided for the interest of the country. Rubio warned that setting up a special impeachment committee with without strong evidence of a crime could, quote, trivialize the process. Ding, ding, ding. Some Republican senators remember that the impeachment of then-President Bill Clinton, we discussed it a bit yesterday, that backfired politically in the 1998 midterm elections when the president's party picked up, Clinton's party picked up five House seats, a notable break from the historical trend where the party in power in the White House generally loses a bunch of seats during midterm elections. Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, who voted twice to convict Trump of impeachment charges, he noted that House Republicans have yet to put forth a specific allegation against Joe Biden, saying, quote, there hasn't been any allegation yet, any conduct which reaches the constitutional standard for impeachment. Romney said he had not seen, quote, any evidence of that nature, unquote, emerging from the House committee's investigation of Biden or from their oversight of the Internal Revenue Service's or the Department of Justice's investigations into Biden family business dealings. But of course, that might be why today Mitt Romney announced he will not be running for a second term in the U.S. Senate next year. Also raising the point, he's only been in the U.S. Senate for one term. It kind of seems like he's been there forever at this point, doesn't it?
True.
Is that just me? Anyway, while Senate Republicans seem to think that the House Republicans are making a pretty huge mistake, even some House Republicans think that House Republicans are making a mistake. Even some of those in the far right so-called Freedom Caucus. That would include Colorado Congressman Ken Buck, a member of the House Freedom Caucus. Over the weekend, he criticized fellow Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene and her conflicting statements about an impeachment timeline, calling them, quote, absurd. Greene, who is a leading proponent of impeaching Joe Biden, last month said that she wouldn't vote for a government funding bill unless the House votes to begin a formal impeachment inquiry. But then last week, she warned against a rushed impeachment vote. So, yeah, if they did hold a vote on the floor of the People's House, who knows? Even Marjorie Taylor Greene might or might not vote against it. Nobody knows. Buck told MSNBC's Inside with Jen Psaki over the weekend, seeming to oppose an official inquiry. He said, quote, the time for impeachment is the time when there's evidence linking President Biden. If there's evidence linking President Biden to a high crime or misdemeanor, that doesn't exist right now, he said, seemingly contradicting Kevin McCarthy and other members of the far right House, including Pennsylvania Congressman and insurrection enthusiast Scott Perry, who got furious at reporters on Tuesday after McCarthy's announcement when the reporters had asked for what actual evidence he had linking any of Hunter Biden's business affairs with Joe Biden. Well, Ken Buck was asked about his remarks on CNN on Tuesday after McCarthy announced the inquiry, and he did not back off them.
2 days ago, you said that the time for impeachment is when there's evidence linking President Biden to a high crime or misdemeanor. You said, quote, that doesn't exist right now. Do you still feel that way tonight?
I have not seen any evidence that links President Biden to Hunter Biden's activities at this point. I will be getting a briefing later in the week. I'm looking forward to understanding more of what the Oversight Committee has uncovered. But at this point, I have not seen that evidence.
Well, House Democrats, for their part, they point out that the Republican investigation into the Biden family has failed to turn up any evidence that would warrant a formal impeachment inquiry, seemingly agreeing with the Freedom Caucus's Ken Buck there. Congressman Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland, the ranking member of the House Oversight Committee, described the House GOP's investigation as, quote, a complete and total bust, and, quote, an epic flop in the history of congressional investigations. He said the evidence amassed so far only, quote, debunks what he called Republican conspiracy theories. So-called moderate House Republicans, such as Congressman Don Bacon of Nebraska, say House GOP investigators have not found any smoking gun that would warrant voting on formal impeachment proceedings. Quote, Bacon said, I think before we move on to an impeachment inquiry, there should be a direct link to the president in some evidence, Bacon told The Hill, with a pretty low bar for impeachment. He said, we should have some clear evidence of a high crime or misdemeanor, not just assuming there may be one. I think we need to have more concrete evidence to go down that path, said Bacon. Silly Don Bacon. Folks like Scott Perry and Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, they think there is plenty of evidence, even if none of it, you know, actually links to Joe Biden, as CNN's Abby Phillip called him out on last night.
I just have to say, I mean, we do have bank records, devices, laptops, travel records, changes in administration policy. Seems like pretty strong evidence to me.
None of which links President Biden to...
Well, it was Joe Biden on the phone.
None of which...
He was calling into the meetings. Wait, Abby, are you actually trying to tell your viewers that you don't believe that Joe Biden was involved in Hunter Biden's business deals?
It's not about what I believe. It's about whether there is evidence that President Biden is linked to the misdeeds that might be linked to Hunter Biden. That's the issue. But I want to get back.
Can you just acknowledge that when he calls into the business deals that he's involved? You don't think that's involvement?
This is not about innuendo. It's not about what I believe. It's a question. Do you have evidence? If you had evidence that Joe Biden was linked to Hunter Biden's business deals in a way that is illegal, we wouldn't be having this conversation. You would probably have the votes for an impeachment inquiry, but you don't, because of people like Ken Buck and people like Don Bacon and many others in your conference.
Well, I see the evidence differently. I think that that's why we need to have the votes and have the debates and have the hearings. And again, they represent their constituents just like I represent mine.
So that was somewhat incoherent.
yeah, it's what happens when you say allegations and then you call that evidence just because you've alleged something.
Just because a father calls his son, who happens to be having dinner with a guy who he's doing business with at the time, that is somehow interceding in his business matters?
Surprise, it's not illegal.
Wow. And it's also not actually a fact. My mother would be shocked to learn how much she's in the middle of my business. If you're arguing with CNN, you're probably losing. As we know by now, Donald Trump's own Department of Justice determined in what is called a slip opinion that the House actually must hold a full floor vote before an impeachment inquiry may be considered legally and constitutionally sound, before an impeachment inquiry may be somehow legally used to get access to things like the president's bank records or to require the executive branch to cooperate in any way with document requests, etc., from the House. That's why the Trump White House refused to do that. They claimed that, impeachment inquiry is completely unsound, unconstitutional, unlawful because there was no vote. Of course, Trump's own Department of Justice was almost certainly hoping to protect Donald Trump at the time that they made their opinion. But that slip opinion apparently remains in effect, even in the Joe Biden Department of Justice. It was eventually revealed publicly for the first time during Trump's first impeachment. By then, by the way, Nancy Pelosi did hold a floor vote on an impeachment inquiry in the People's House a little over a month after she had unilaterally announced the inquiry, and the House voted 232 to 196 to open that inquiry. We will see if Kevin McCarthy ever holds such a vote, because at least based on his broken promise from just 11 days earlier, it kind of sort of feels to me like Kevin ain't got the votes to win an impeachment inquiry resolution in the U.S. House. But we shall see. In the meantime, despite his efforts to win over his far right flank with an impeachment inquiry, McCarthy also does not appear to have a viable plan to keep the government open. That, according to several lawmakers who spoke to AP, one plan that McCarthy is floating with, I think, no more than 10 legislative days left at this point, The government must pass about a dozen spending bills or a continuing resolution to just keep it open, as Republicans continue to fail to pass a bill to any bills to do so in the House to avert a shutdown of the government on October 1. One of his plans is to ask the House to approve as many bills as they possibly can, send them over to the Senate, no matter how objectionable they are, and let the Senate sort it all out. The chamber came to a standstill on Wednesday with a Defense Department bill related military spending that Republicans themselves were blocking. That now appears to be in jeopardy. Far-right Republicans are demanding McCarthy commit to a total spending amount for the coming fiscal year, which begins October 1. He is not likely to be able to fulfill that, reports AP. So we go from one crisis, made up or otherwise, to the next. So is it any wonder that few, if any, Americans actually know about, you know, what Joe Biden and the Democrats have actually done through some of the extraordinary legislation, in fact, that they actually passed back when Democrats had control of the House before this year? Well, one of them, one of the things that they passed is the landmark Inflation Reduction Act. And yes, the great David Roberts of Volts is here to talk about it next, because somebody has to. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Yes, please do look what's going down, because Lord knows the mainstream corporate broadcast media ain't going to spend much time telling you about it, no matter how it seems that Democrats and the Biden administration are at least trying to let you know about it, trying to let you know what's going down, really all over the country. But you will have to pay close attention to notice, amid all of the indictments and the pretend impeachments and even major climate disasters, which would seem to give a perfect opportunity for some of those news outlets to cover this. But, well, let's, you know, don't hold your breath. Welcome back to The Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As we discussed several weeks ago, amid this year's long, record cruel summer, the hottest summer ever lived through by humans on this planet, the Associated Press was kind enough to report on the first anniversary last month of Joe Biden and the Democrats' now one-year-old landmark climate law known as the Inflation Reduction Act, as already, quote, turbocharging clean energy technology in the U.S. In less than a year, AP reports, the IRA, America's long-sought, if poorly named, response to climate change, has prompted investments in a massive build-out of battery and EV manufacturing across the states, with nearly 80 major clean energy manufacturing facilities having been announced. That is an investment equal to the previous 7 years combined, according to the American Clean Power Association. Quote, it seems like every week there's a new factory facility somewhere being announced. That, according to Jesse Jenkins, a professor at Princeton and a leader of the Repeat Project, which has been deeply involved in analysis of the law. He added, quote, we have been talking about bringing manufacturing jobs back to America for my entire life. We're finally doing it. That's pretty exciting, he said. The IRA, AP notes, is America's most significant response to climate change after decades of lobbying by oil, gas, and coal interests have stalled action, even while carbon emissions climbed, creating a hotter, more dangerous world. The law is designed to spur clean energy build-out on a scale that will bend the arc of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. It also aims to build domestic supply chains to reverse China's and other nations' early domination of this vital sector. Last month, AP suggested that it was going well, even if most Americans don't yet seem to know about any of this in these early stages. One target of the law is cleaner transportation. That's the largest source of climate pollution for the U.S. Siemens, for example, one of the biggest tech companies in the world, produces charging stations for EVs, which is said to be driving demand for batteries much higher. Siemens USA has now invested $260 million in battery or battery storage projects, much of that following adoption of the IRA. The law also encourages more of the type of batteries that feed electricity to the grid when the sun is not hitting solar panels at night or during times when wind power is not producing enough. That could put the storage business on the same upward trajectory that we've seen from solar over the past decade, according to experts. Derek Flackel, the North American policy associate at Bloomberg NEF, pointed out that that sales at the largest manufacturer of solar panels in the U.S., First Solar, skyrocketed after the law passed. Now, we've been referring to the IRA as a $400 billion investment, but in truth, as climate and energy reporter David Roberts told us on this program right after the bill's passage a year ago, it could actually be much, much higher than that, given the open-ended way that the law is structured to allow businesses to continue obtaining funding to build out our clean energy future, even beyond those $400 billion. The law is supposed to reduce the emissions of the U.S., the country most responsible for greenhouse gases historically, by as much as 41% by 2030. That, according to a new analysis by Princeton researchers, that's not enough to hit U.S. goals, but it is a start. Despite the new investments, many of which are actually in red states, Republicans who are so bought and sold by the fossil fuel industry that they're actually willing to harm their own constituents by opposing investments in their own states and communities to ensure that the campaign cash from big oil, gas, and coal keeps coming in, they actually proposed repealing the major elements of this landmark law as one of their bargaining chips to keep the government from shutting down at the end of this month. That hasn't stopped many of them, on the other hand, from showing up at new manufacturing facilities in their own local jurisdictions and taking credit or trying to for some of these huge facilities and the enormous number of jobs many of them have created, thanks to funding from the IRA, which not one single Republican voted for in the House or Senate. Princeton's Professor Jenkins predicted, quote, "I think we're about to see quite a flood of investment in wind and solar-related manufacturing in the U.S., citing 2026 and 2028 as when the country will see the law's full impact. Of course, 26 and 28 will be swell, but it won't necessarily help Joe Biden or the Democrats win in 2024 as they continue to struggle to get out the objective message of the extraordinary accomplishments during Biden's first term, particularly when it comes to clean energy and manufacturing jobs. No matter how well the IRA and the separate bipartisan infrastructure bill may be working on paper, but that too could change as homeowners begin to see how much they can personally benefit from the IRA's many, if still largely unknown, provisions. As Grist reported recently, residential energy use accounts for one-fifth of climate warming greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., but President Biden's landmark bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, also takes aim at this issue by allocating almost $9 billion to home energy efficiency rebates, primarily for low and moderate income households. Quote, For the federal government, this is the largest investment in history, said Mark Krasowicz, senior policy director at the nonprofit American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. These rebates have the potential to provide tremendous support in terms of reducing pollution, reducing energy costs, and making homes more comfortable. States, however, will administer the rebate program under guidance from the Department of Energy released in late July. The money could become available to consumers as early as the end of this year, though the bulk is expected throughout 2024. In some cases, the incentives could cover the entire cost of a project in your home, but only, of course, if you know about it. Incentives will fall into two buckets mainly, with about half designed for home electrification and the remainder going toward overall reductions in energy use. That's right, you can get paid to simply reduce your energy usage. Get paid to save money on energy. On the electrification front, the guidelines call for up to $8,000 for incredibly efficient next-generation all-electric heat pumps, $840 for things like next-generation induction stoves, $40,000 to upgrade electric panels to help service solar panels and EVs, among other incentives. The discounts are largely designed to be available when the items are purchased, which means you can avoid having to pay out of pocket and then wait for a government check. For the energy reduction incentives, the type of technology used doesn't actually matter as long as the households lower their overall energy use. Homeowners could do this by installing more insulation, sealing windows, upgrading to more efficient heating and cooling systems, among other options. For many people, the Inflation Reduction Act could help put such projects like these within financial reach for the first time. But the latest rebates will be available only after states have set up their respective programs. And of course, well, for that reason, a lot of people may have trouble getting access to these programs. They may not be available everywhere. Florida, Iowa, Kentucky, South Dakota have so far declined to apply for IRA funds, and they could reject the home energy rebates as well. So, sorry, people who live in Florida, Iowa, Kentucky, South Dakota. Your elected officials don't want you to save money on energy costs, apparently, much less fight the climate crisis in those states. Well, Florida, I guess, is not much affected anyway by such things, right? Federal tax credits, however, are available right now to help anyone pursuing projects like installing solar panels or electric heat pump water heaters, according to Grist. This initial tranche of $9 billion or so, however, is just a drop in the bucket. There are 26 million low-income households that still use fossil fuels for heating. Electrifying all of them would cost about $780 billion. Nonetheless, this is a start, and according to experts, it is a big one. At least that's what the Biden administration is hoping. Quote, there's some real urgency to making sure that we try to get the fossil fuels out of our homes, said Sage Briscoe of the electrification nonprofit Rewiring America. They were a big force behind the structuring of the IRA, with Briscoe noting, quote, the climate isn't going to wait. Well, if there's anything I'm hoping Americans have learned over the last several cruel months of summer here, it is that things are getting worse and quickly, and no, the climate is not waiting. So is the Inflation Reduction Act, a year after passage, even beginning to make a dent in this problem? And is it working as planned to date? And will it make any difference in time for next year's critical elections across the country? Last summer, following the IRA's passage, again, by Democrats only, as Joe Biden kind of stunned all of us when this legislation, sort of a second shot at his Build Back Better program, appeared. Last year, we were joined to discuss it by an unusually giddy at the time, if I remember correctly, David Roberts. He is the longtime politics, climate, and energy journalist who previously wrote for Grist and Vox.com. He now publishes his own newsletter and podcast called Volts. Joining us again today, just over 1 year after the IRA took effect, is David Roberts. Oh, Mr. Roberts, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Hey, Brad, how's it going?
Well, you're here to tell me, I guess. The AP, as I said, noted the IRA is designed to spur clean energy build out on a scale that will bend the arc of the U.S. greenhouse gas emissions to replace using domestic supply chains to reverse China's domination of this sector. So I realize we're only 1 year into this thing, David, but as someone who follows what's actually happening as the law is beginning to roll out, does it appear a year later that it might actually bend the arc of our greenhouse gas emissions and or reverse domination by China with new domestic supply chains in this sector?
Well, this is an unsatisfying answer, I realize, but it is too early to tell.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It is because the IRA's goals are so vast mm-hmm. that it will only be over the course of 5 to 10 years that we really have any understanding of whether it pulled it off. I mean, it's trying to do enormous things.
Right.
So, I mean, what we definitely can say is one of the goals, which was to spur private investment into these products and supply chains in the U.S., is absolutely working. I mean, as you said in your introduction, I don't know what the current number is. Last mm-hmm. I looked, it's like $270 billion worth of private investment mm-hmm. flooding into the U.S. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a second goal of the IRA, not as public, but certainly a private goal on the part of Democrats is, you know, if you talk to some Biden people sort of behind the scenes, mm-hmm. they will tell you that this sort of apocalyptic terror you have about the future of democracy is not crazy.
Right. Yeah.
We're in a perilous, perilous moment.
Yep.
And part of the thinking behind IRA was it's these parts of the country that were hollowed out by globalization, hollowed out by decades of sort of reflexive kind of free trade dogma. It's these parts of the country that have experienced this reactionary backlash that we've all been living through for mm-hmm. the past little while. And if that goes on, U.S. democracy is in serious trouble, like serious existential trouble.
Correct.
Like they're not. So I just want to reassure people who are freaked out about that. They're not crazy. And there are people mm-hmm. are freaked out about that all the way up to the top. And so part of the goal of IRA was to channel investment into those areas. And that is happening. Like that's most of the investment is coming into Southern and Midwestern states, like First Solar. You mentioned First Solar.
Yeah.
They are investing $1.2 billion into a facility in Louisiana. And that is the single largest investment in that state's history, the largest private investment in that state's history. And mm-hmm. you can tell stories like that about Georgia and West Virginia. So,
well, that
spurring investment, yes, it's succeeding. Is it succeeding in muting that reactionary backlash? Is it succeeding in muting these horrendous politics we've dealt with? Is it succeeding in turning a few swing voters in those swing states to help Joe Biden get back into office? That we don't know yet. And as you say, part of the problem is that like our media ecosystem is broken and dysfunctional and people just don't know about it.
Yeah. And if they don't know about it, I mean, I'm really interested, David Roberts, that you tied those two things together, these sort of two existential crises at once, the crises of democracy yes. itself, and of course, the climate crisis, and how they all seem to, or at least the hope is, they would come together in this bill to sort of try to at least begin solving both. One important point, when we had you on a year ago, it was just last time you were on, I think it's been a year, it was just after the passage of the IRA, you noted a point that has kind of stuck with me ever since. And that one of the geniuses of this measure, as you saw it at the time, was that it was structured akin to the way the defense spending is structured, if I recall, where each state in the union sort of gets various major projects, which you know, means that killing any of in the defense industry, you know, you can't kill any of those industries because it's opposed by the local and state elected officials. And that they're trying to do something similar here when it comes to, you know, climate renewable energy technology. Is that playing out as you had expected or as you had hoped so far?
Well, it's interesting. You're seeing the projects flood into the states. Like it's that's happening. You know, you still have like Trump, for instance, planting a flag in the ground against EVs, squarely against EVs, because he's trying to say it'll be worse for union workers. You know, so you still
he's saying that we're not going to go with EVs because it's bad for unions.
Yes, his theory is that jobs making EVs are fewer and worse than jobs making gas cars.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, it's hilarious. Yeah. It's hilarious because there were strong union provisions in the EV tax credits, which Manchin stripped out because the big Toyota factory in West Virginia is not unionized. So it was like Manchin who, you know, took a lot of that stuff out. But so there's still on the surface of the Republican Party opposition to clean energy. And if you look at the sort of poll numbers, like the polling for EVs and all that stuff has gone down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're leaning heavily on, they're trying to ban your stove. They're trying to ban your everything, you know, like they're leaning on that. So at least at the headline level, it hasn't dented Republican anti-clean energy policy. But, you know, that's not to say there's not stuff going on beneath the surface. So just the question is, and this is one of the critiques I make of kind of the bill and of Democrats and of the whole left, really, is, you know, everybody's such a friggin' policy wonk on the left. Everybody's such a policy person and a technology person and an economics person. But the fact that a factory opened up down the road from you and your cousin got a job there, you don't necessarily know instinctively just from hearing that what that means. What is the significance of that? What does it say about larger trends?
For these factories to be opening, for these investments to be made, all these, you know, ribbon cuttings, you don't necessarily know what it means about the larger macro economy, about the political parties, about the direction of the country. Mm-hmm. So you don't necessarily know to tie them all together and to attribute them to Democrats. Like, that story does not tell itself.
How do you get it across? I mean, I got to say, you know, Biden and Kamala Harris, they have been appearing all over the country at these factory openings and groundbreakings and so forth. But if they're not actually covered by the media, with broadcast media, which goes, you know, 2 minutes on that and 24 hours and 58 minutes on everything else, how do you tell that story?
I mean, this is the $6 million question. I mean, we, you know, I'm sure we've discussed before how broken the media is and how difficult it is to get it to focus on these things. But also, I think there's a huge role here for NGOs, for the green movement. And I think they know that. Like, I've done a couple of pods on it now with people, and I think the green movement understands that how big an impact this bill will have is not built in to the structure, right? Like, it is all about implementation. Like, the not just like the economic effects and the political effects are both to be written. They're both, you know, TBD. So they need to do a lot of work connecting communities with this money that's available, for one thing, just to spend more of the money, right? Like, as we said, these are uncapped tax credits. So the more people line up for them, the more they get. So we need to, you know, get people lining up for them. And, you know, while doing that, telling people the story of what's happening, telling them what it means that it's happening, you know, like the green movement, like, you see these polls, like, even sort of green voters will tell pollsters, like, Biden's not doing enough for climate. I heard he opened up some willow oil field. No, I've never heard of the IRA.
Right.
Like, I can't tell you how many times I've seen that in polls, and that's maddening. Like, somehow bad news, somehow negative news about Biden and the Democrats betraying you again, blah, blah, blah. Like, that always gets out. That always makes it out. And somehow the good news isn't making it out. So this is a, you know, the bigger question than we can chew over here, but just how does the left build a communications machine and get the news to voters about what it's doing? The mainstream media is failing it. Right-wing media is actively working against it. It doesn't really have a media of its own. So how to get the grassroots mobilized and people, you know, person to person sort of storytelling going about this, how to get the story out, is a very difficult, knotty problem that's not going to be solved just by passing legislation. That's ongoing struggle for the left. But like that's what's going to make or break this effort in the big term, I think, is just whether people are able to put it together, whether it makes it to voters, whether voters attribute it to the people who did it.
So you mean I had you on the show to tell me how to get the message out, and you're saying your answer is, man, I don't know. So I think, let me ask you this, because, you know, one thing that I'll bet everyone knows about, I bet everyone knows that they held up the U.S. Open with a climate protest by gluing their feet to the stands or whatever they did. I bet they know about, you know, there was a demonstration blocking the road to Burning Man. They know when they throw, you know, paint on the Mona Lisa or something, that word gets out. Is I wasn't gonna ask you about this, but is you know, I know that a lot of people, even on the left, get furious about those sorts of demonstrations, but it does get the word out. On the other hand, is the word that it is getting out not a good one, not a helpful one, not a useful one? Would it be better if somehow similar tactics were used, and I don't know how you do it, to glue your feet to the U.S. Open and then tell them about tax credits for heat pumps? I mean, can we combine those two ideas somehow, David?
Well, you're hitting on exactly the right question, right? Like, those are the protests that get attention, and they're all sort of oppositional. They're all just sort of, you know, at best opposing something or raising awareness, you know, awareness. And I'm actually just interviewed a guy, got a pod coming out next week, a guy from 350.org, the activist group, and they are getting ready to launch an explicit campaign, you know, the sort of explicit sort of story of which is, we're trying to turn away from just blocking things and stopping things to spurring the building of things, right? Because that's the turn everybody needs now, right? Like, that's sort of what everybody agrees is needed now. Like, it's a time for building. We've got to build an enormous amount of stuff to make this work. And building is difficult in the U.S. for a bunch of reasons, bureaucratic reasons, political reasons, on and on. So what role can the movement, can NGOs play in spurring build out? And that is like a new thing in the world. It's a new role for them. And it's not obvious how to do it. Like, I think they're going to start by going after utilities, you know, because utilities are sort of the entities that are standing in the way of a lot of this stuff, or slowing a lot of this stuff down. So that kind of gives them like a bad guy within this frame of trying to build more stuff.
But what does that practically mean, going after the utilities? How does that actually work? How do they go after them?
Well, I mean, how exactly they're going to do it is TBD, but it could be everything from on the, you know, sort of PR campaigns against them, you know, like work their ratepayers up against them and get people to sort of start contacting their legislators and their industry regulators trying to get utilities reformed. Or nitty gritty, you're talking about just like going to PUC meetings, going to the meetings of the Public Utility Commission in your state. Those things determine the fate of an enormous amount of energy policy, but they're technical and they're mostly ignored and they mostly go on in obscurity. So just getting people power into those meetings can have a huge difference. Or shareholder, you know, and their shareholder activism as well. And then another piece of this is in Maine, they're trying, their putting a ballot measure on the ballot this year that would basically get rid of the state's two investor-owned utilities and replace them with a single publicly owned utility, a main public utility, basically, with the theory being, you know, without the profit motive, you know, without this need for like 8 to 15% yearly returns that you have in the investor-owned utility segment. If their capital could be more patient, it could be you could do stuff that doesn't produce any profit. Like, I mean, this is one of the problems for utilities is like if they make their customers more efficient, energy efficient, all that does is reduce their profit. Right. So why would they want to do that? Like they have to be forced to do it. But if you're a public utility and your only goals are public goals, the thought is you'll act with more alacrity. You'll be more purposeful. You'll be more public spirited. That also kind of remains to be seen, but that's one of the ways to go after this. This is like a new thing in the world, trying to figure out how to use public pressure and activism in a positive, generative way to get things built.
Well, yeah, and it's something that folks on the right and certainly folks in the fossil fuel industry seemingly have figured out how to do. We had Peter Sinclair on the show a few months back, and he was talking about, you know, in these rural areas where, you know, they're trying to set up wind farms and so forth, working with farmers and whatnot. All of a sudden, they have these tiny town meetings where scores and scores of people show up somehow, people they've never seen at these town meetings, you know, demanding that they don't build a windmill. It's going to kill us all. Somehow, the folks on the at the fossil fuel companies have figured out how to mobilize those people to show up at those town halls. Is that something that can be? I don't know how they do it. Is something that can be replicated on the left, or do you have to tick people off so much that they're angry and they think they're going to die if they don't show up to the town hall meeting?
I mean, part of the answer is spend 5 decades building that machine, right? I mean, that machine is built now. Like that sort of fake grassroots, astroturf, well-funded misinformation at the local level. Like, they know how to do that. They've done that a million times on a million different issues. So the whole machine is built, and you just have to kind of turn it a couple of degrees towards something new. But all the pieces are there. All the funding is there. All the sort of like wing nuts on the ground who have already been told this crazy stuff, they're there. They just need to be sort of like organized and bussed to the meeting. So the left is so far behind on that stuff, which is a problem across the board. But here, again, a problem. Like, are there groups of people in coordinated T-shirts showing up at these local meetings shouting, yes, give me my wind turbine? You know, I don't think there are yet. And there needs to be, because like we're leaving that field unoccupied and it's completely dominated now by misinformation. And you see rural areas in polls, you see it. They're turning against wind. They're turning against solar. Like it's working. There's just no real counter movement, you know, on the ground. The green movement has been so technocratic and so wonky and such an inside game for so long that like rediscovering how to do grassroots, you know, on the ground in the community work on the scale required is like something they're frantically trying to sort of figure out on the fly after a long time of letting those muscles atrophy.
Well, I'm going to blame you, David Roberts, for the wonkiness part.
No,
yeah, I think that's you. but listen, before I go, as I understand it, speaking of, you know, telling stories to help move this all in the right direction, you have, as I understand it, been undertaking electrification projects yourself on your own home. What have you done? How's it going? And have you been able to take advantage of any of the Inflation Reduction Act's many incentives for those upgrades yet? And sorry to ask you that huge question with only a minute or two left to let you answer.
I have not been. Actually, what I want to do is reverse the terrible decision I made about 10 years ago to put in a gas furnace into my home, which I've been ruing and regretting and beating myself up over ever since then. So once the credits are established, like once they're out, I think I'm going to have another go at a heat pump, and you better, you know, of course, better believe I'll be podcasting about it through the whole thing. So we'll see how smooth, because the last time I was replacing an oil furnace and like the contractors didn't know what a heat pump was. They had all sorts of weird myths about heat pumps in their heads.
Yeah.
There were no incentives available from anyone, local or federal, for me to do that. Like, I basically just got railroaded into replacing oil with gas. So it'll be interesting to go back at it this time and see, are there contractors who have gotten a clue? Are the credits easy to get? Is the technology better? I'm gonna find out all that stuff real soon.
Okay, good. Because yeah, I my mom went to a car dealer and said I'd like to look at an electric car, and they're like, well, we don't have any electric cars.
Same problem.
Yeah.
Same problem. There's a lot of old fogies in charge of these sort of institutions that are supposed to be spreading these technologies who are not yet clued in about them. So we'll see how long it takes to clear some of that chaff out of the way and get a new younger generation of people who speak this language and understand these things and know how to talk about them and sell them.
Yeah. And it shouldn't be that hard, but I guess it is. I guess it's much easier to say they're coming for your gas stoves.
Yes. Everything is easier if you can just lie and be a jerk.
Never lying, never a jerk is David Roberts. Many years writing about politics, climate, and energy, of course, for Vox.com and Grist. He now has his very own newsletter and podcast called Volts.WTF. That's right. Volts.WTF is where you'll find it, where you can sign up, where you can listen, and everything else. You can also find him, I think, maybe still on the site still known as Twitter at
believe it or not.
Yep. At Dr. Volts. But otherwise just go to volts.wtf. David Roberts, thanks so much. Well, we'll talk to you next year, I guess.
Thanks, Brad. It's always fun.
Thank you. Okay, we have got to get out.
Yes, but it's great to talk to David. His Volts podcast is awesome.
It is indeed. I agree. But I still have to get out.
Yes.
So thank you very much to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or just want to hear it again or hear any other program we've ever done, you can download it for free at bradblog.com. Thanks to those of you kind enough, generous enough to help support our work that we try to do every day over your public airwaves by hitting one of those donate links or just going to bradblog.com/donate. You can drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter, you will find me at The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Till we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
To the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.